Howdy, folks. Today, we're going to dive deep into storytelling in sports photography with one of the best, right after the. Welcome to Camera Shake, where we bring you the insider scoop on all things photography and videography, giving you a unique opportunity to stay ahead of the curve. As always, I'm your host, Kirsten Nutz, and before we get into it, I've got one thing to ask of you. I've noticed that over 65% of our viewers on YouTube and listeners in audio are not actually subscribed to this channel. That's depressing. You could really help us out by hitting that subscribe button. It'll help us get even more amazing guests on the show, if that's even possible. But it'll just take you one click. It'll take a mere second. Thank you so much. Now, without further ado, let's give it up for today's special guest. She's shot the biggest names in baseball all over the world. She's a Sony artisan of imagery, author, and generally one of the nicest people in the game. Jean, how are things?
Things are good. We're moving along, working on a new project, and it's full steam ahead these days. So lots of traveling and lots of exciting shoots and not a lot of sleep.
Yeah, you seem to be all over the world, because like, we've been emailing back and forth a little bit, and it's like you were like, where were you last? Was it Puerto Rico or something?
Oh, yeah. Well, I was in maybe Cuba. So, yeah, I mean, it's kind of been, for the project, we've been in Uganda, followed by Cuba, Puerto Rico, and then I was in the Dominican Republic, and tomorrow I'm going to South Korea.
So, oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it.
So. Phenomenally. Tell us a little bit about that latest project of yours.
The project is part of a, we have an organization, my partner and I, Jeff Idelson, and it's called Grassroots Baseball. And it's a not-for-profit, and it celebrates the game of baseball and started off by giving back at the youngest level, doing clinics with young kids, and with the idea that kids who play sports have better outcomes in health, better outcomes in school, better outcomes in life. You know, with it doesn't need to be baseball, of course, but that's what we like. But really, any sport, you know, is a healthier choice for kids. And that was our first initiative when we started the not-for-profit. And then we did a program. That program was along Route 66. So we tied in working with these kids all along Route 66 for 3 years. And now our new project is Grassroots Baseball Women, and we've been telling the stories of girls and women playing baseball on the field, off the field, you know, in baseball around the globe, the past, the present, the future. And it's really just been a rewarding project. And so many times when I say, oh, I'm going to photograph a girls' baseball game, and people say, oh, you mean softball? And I say, nope, I mean baseball. And so many people don't even know that girls play baseball, and it's and not only do they play it here in the U.S., but they play it in many places around the world. So it's been a fun project, and, you know, it just does a lot for women. Again, any sport, you know, what it does for a girl, you know, the confidence that a girl gets being part of a team and all the things that team sports give, you know, and then girls in particular, it's really nice to see what the sport can do for them.
And, you know, when I've been looking through your work, the one thing that really I found really fascinating was the fact that, I mean, you shot some of the biggest stars in baseball in some of the biggest stadiums in the world. And one of the things I read about you is that you take out the time to really go and shoot grassroots baseball games, like street baseball. So I find it really fascinating how you managed to really combine all of that and you know, have the passion really for the sport, even at a grassroots level.
Yeah, you know, well, you'll appreciate this as a photographer, right? You have photographers who I also teach photography, sports photography. And so many times you get the question of, how do I get a credential to get into a major league stadium? How do I get to, and everybody's goal is to shoot at this high level, right? To shoot at the World Series, to shoot at the Olympics. And sure, that's thrilling and exciting. But pictures can be made anywhere. And in many cases, better pictures can be made in places that are not these big stadiums where you don't have access and you're told to stand in this little box behind this rope and you can't move. And The game starts at 8 p.m., so the light is gone, and you get what you get. And not that that's not exhilarating, but I feel like if we can let it go as photographers and not worry about the who, but worry about the what, you can just make such beautiful pictures, you know, and taking these grassroots subjects in whatever sport you might be shooting, soccer or, you know, just cricket. What do you guys play over there?
Yeah, crickets. Cricket.
Yeah. People who have patience for cricket, then baseball is nothing. So, right? Yeah, those games could go on. But whatever the game is, when you can shoot it at a 4 p.m. or 5 p.m. start, right, with pretty light, and you have a beautiful background, and you have access for angles, then you make pictures. And to me, when I shoot my grassroots work and I shoot these kids, I shoot them like they're major leaguers, like they're the big stars, giving them, you know, with the same equipment, with the same care, with the same planning, and with angles that make them look big and heroic. And it's so rewarding, you know, on every level, and especially as a photographer making pretty pictures.
And, you know, I love that concept. I do a similar thing in music photography. So, you know, usually it's very similar. You know, when it comes to music photography, people often think like, oh, I want to shoot at, you know, the O2 Arena or, you know, at the Royal Albert Hall. And I want to shoot like the biggest names in the business sort of thing. And that is cool. Don't get me wrong. I've shot at the Albert Hall many times, and I've recently had the opportunity to shoot the O2 Arena with my friend David Bergman, which was a phenomenal experience. But I also love, maybe I love that even more, I shoot young bands it's called a Battle of the Bands competition. And what I do is there's about 10 bands that take part in this. It happens every year. But what I do is I make a point in doing a full professional photo shoot with each one of those bands. And they might be as young as 13 or something, right? Some of them might be even younger. They might be, you know, stuff from 11, between 11 and 18, let's say. So the idea is basically, on one hand, nobody should go home empty-handed, even if they don't win the competition. But also, it's extremely empowering for those young kids to have like really awesome professional images that they can then use, you know, on their social media. And it just gives them maybe even more impetus and more energy to carry on making music. You know, that's the thing. So I completely, identify with that, you know, that joy of shooting grassroots.
Yeah. To me, that makes so much sense, and it's perfect. It's so there, you know, there it is. It doesn't need to be sports. It's really, I mean, music photography is a great example of that. And so, and maybe where you are, maybe where this band is playing is someplace like old and gritty. Maybe it's some gritty bar. Well, gritty bars make great photos, right? It doesn't need to be Albert Hall, though. I've been to Albert Hall and it's quite beautiful. I'd like to shoot in Albert Hall, so I have to say.
I don't know. You get to work out. I tell you this. I mean, one of the mistakes I've made, so I've shot, well, I don't know. I mean, I've shot the Albert Hall probably maybe 5 or 6 times. And the first time I shot it, I made the mistake of not realizing that damn building has so many stairs. I woke up the next morning and I couldn't feel my legs. I mean, it's, you know, it was unbelievable. It's one of the, I mean, it's a beautiful building, but of course it was never really built for, you know, 21st century performances, and especially not with photographers in mind. So they would have put in more elevators, I think, if they thought about it.
I think all of the UK seems like that to me. Stairs are part of the deal. Like, just, you know, your subways, man, there's some steps there. You got to know. You got to pack light.
Yeah. And you know, this is always, I mean, this, I fully agree. And my thing is always like, well, what do you do if you're in a wheelchair? Like, you don't stand a chance in that, you know, or if you're on, like, you know, I don't know if you have a Zimmer frame, forget it. That's no way you can get through that system.
But your point of, for sure, like the, you know, whoever's shooting music, don't worry about the who, worry about the what. I mean, think about what you can do if you're with a young band. You know, you get the access. Maybe you can even stand on the stage and get some close-up or get some angle. You wouldn't be able, you're certainly not standing on the stage at Albert Hall, you know, or getting real close to the musician and getting tight on his instrument or her instrument. And just, I mean, it's the same thing. It's where you can have access and where you can make pictures.
And also, of course, you know, as a photographer, it's such an amazing training ground. You know, if you're interested in sports photography, and I know there's lots of people who are interested in sports photography because I know, you know, people who are members of local camera clubs, for example, and sports photography is a thing. You know, they always look at the calendar and think like, oh, there's a hockey event going on or an athletics event going on, and then, you know, there's a pilgrimage to that event and people take photos. But I think like, well, there's so many grassroots events where you can really get the experience as a sports photographer to just simply get better. And there's so many opportunities out there.
So many. And, you know, people say, oh, I don't know where to shoot or I don't have access. You just got to do a little digging. I was just shooting for my project in Palm Springs. And it was this really nice stadium with a beautiful background. There was mountains and some snow on the top. And there was one guy there, a young guy who was shooting. I was just there for my project. And I was like, look at him. And he said, oh, yeah, I'm getting much better. And he had all the access in the world. And these are athletes who could very well be playing in the major leagues in a year or two. And he's just there. He's walking on the field. He's getting anything he wants. He has total access. And so it's a great training ground for him. He's building a portfolio, building relationships, learning, and making just terrific pictures. You're certainly not going to do that at Yankee Stadium. And it's such a lesson.
Yeah, that's it. And you're absolutely right. You know, what you said earlier about getting access and getting close to, you know, the performers or the athletes. You're absolutely right. Like in a small venue, but just, you know, relate that to music photography again. In a small venue, you can get really up and close, you know, to the performers on stage. In a big venue like the O2 Arena, it's massive. You know, if you're lucky enough to be right in front of the stage, then yeah. But if you're anywhere else, anything you're going to photograph is going to be about this big in a frame, you know. So it's much easier to do that in a smaller pub, as we call them here, or, you know, or a bar. And also for me, that's always where the stories are.
Oh, yeah. And like in shooting with long lenses, make beautiful pictures, no doubt. So you're shooting with telephoto lenses, those musicians or athletes, and they're beautiful. But there's also nothing like mixing up your take, you know, or telling your story with a wide angle. But being able to be right up against that stage or against that athlete or right in it, I mean, you could tell the difference. You see the picture. The picture is more intimate. You know, it's very obvious. Like, this was shot with a wide angle. You're right there with that person. Yeah. And I mean, it's a different picture, a beautiful picture.
Absolutely. How did you first get into sports photography, and in particular, I call it baseball photography? What was your journey into that?
I was a portrait photographer. I was shooting with two women who were doing all black and white film portraits, and they were just using natural light, and they were going on location. And I knew darkroom work. I learned darkroom work in high school, and not that well, actually. I got better as I went, but I offered to do their printing in exchange for going on shoots with them. And they said yes. And I started printing their work, and they were a beautiful darkroom. It was small, but it was great. And they printed on beautiful paper. Their work was really just absolutely lovely. And they started taking me on shoots with them. And then we got a studio space in a barn. So we were able to then do simple lighting and have an indoor-outdoor space and have the clients come to us. So I kind of grew with them as well. But they were great mentors for me. And, you know, just starting in film was a nice way to start. You learn a lot with what you can do in a dark room, you know, and take that with you. But it was never my passion. It was just where the opportunity was. And so I was also studying other types of photography, and I was working with other photographers. So I was doing all kinds of things. I shot weddings, a little bit of music, you know, just anything that I could, so I could figure out my path. And then I had an opportunity to work for local newspapers shooting sports. And when I got that gig, I never looked back. I absolutely loved it. There was no doubt that this is what I wanted to do. And I was good at baseball because I was a baseball coach for my son. So the baseball photography felt more natural to me because the more you know the game, the better you shoot it. And I thought I knew football. But when I first started shooting football, what I thought I knew and the reality of what I really knew was very different. And so it was a learning curve more than I expected. And but then, you know, it just grew, and then just shooting all these different sports, those local newspapers. So I was shooting youth sports, high school sports, college sports, and then eventually professional sports. And it was just a terrific journey, really, of learning everything that I needed to. When I was shooting baseball, I was great. When I was shooting football on dark fields, I realized my gear wasn't the right gear, you know. So then you're really learning on the job of what you need. And I had a lot of people helping me along the way, a lot of great mentors that are still great friends to me today. So now I'm trying to teach and complete that circle and give back like they gave to me.
Was that a difficult transition initially going from portraiture into shooting sports? Because the demands, photographically speaking, are very, very different.
Very different. And the baseball was good because I was shooting the baseball and it was mostly day games. And I knew the sport and I had access. So I was able to work with the gear that I have and still make some decent pictures. When I moved to football, which happened right away, it was one of my first assignments. I went to my first high school football game. It was really dark and the gear that I had absolutely was not going to cut it. And the game went on and I was not making pictures. And even though it was cold, I felt the sweat dripping down the back of my neck as like the game was over and I didn't have anything great. And I had to go to the sports editor and say, hey, I had a little few problems, but I'll have it all solved by next Friday. Don't worry. It'll all be okay. He said, okay, yeah, just send me what you have, though. Send me the best. You know, they have a deadline. And I'm like, yeah, well, I didn't really get very much. And, you know, we went back and forth and the emails got quicker and faster. And so quickly I had to learn and get the right gear to shoot sports. And my friend connected me to Michael Zagaris, who's the San Francisco 49ers photographer and the Oakland A's photographer. And I met with him the next week. And he let me know that I did have all the wrong gear. And then I was able to get some loaners and start shooting. And then I also got to learn from him. And he started taking me to games. And I had the opportunity to assist him. So I was learning on the big field so I could get my small job done. And so it was very fortunate the way things worked out. And he was just so helpful to my career. But the portraiture came in quite handy, I think. Portraits are probably the hardest thing to do, right? Connecting with a person. And sometimes you have very little time to do it. I think everybody should learn how to do portraits because it just helps you with whatever job that you have. I mean, the portraiture that I learned before, you know, just helps me so much in what I'm doing now. You know, it helps you with everything. And Michael Zagaris, who was one of my first sports mentors, nobody was better at using a wide angle and connecting with people fast. And he could make just incredible scenes of games, you know, and the most exciting stuff for him happened before the game even started. So learning from him was a different style that I took with me. So it's all about the mentors.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's a huge element of portraiture in sports photography, especially if you imagine like shots, first of all, sort of behind the scenes shots, you know, shots that happen in between the actual gameplay, you know, where the sort of emotions really show, you know, depending on what's happening in the game. Like the game might be going totally the wrong way and people might be disappointed and it might all be written on their faces. And then, you know, being able to capture that is, you know, that's really what makes sports photography so beautiful for me anyway. Because I always think that, I mean, over here there's a lot of football, soccer, as you call it, and rugby. Actually, rugby is the other thing. I think rugby is a big thing over here. You know, but it's like there. I was just thinking about like you know, soccer photography. I mean, there are only really so many images you can take of somebody kicking a ball, as I always think, you know. And it's all of the stuff that happens in between the gameplay that always fascinates me. Again, from a storytelling perspective, you know, I'm always fascinated with that, like the reactions, like, you know, somebody scores a goal, and then, you know, just look at the face of the goalkeeper. Like the disappointment and the pain. Maybe they've just realized that they've lost the whole game, you know, at this point or so, you know, this is, I always find that very, very fascinating.
Oh, exactly. It's exactly right. I mean, you're right. Action is exhilarating, but it's only a part of the story. So with every action, there's a reaction, action from the athlete, what's the reaction of that same athlete? Maybe they scored a goal and you're getting them roaring. That's the reaction. Action, reaction. They score the goal, the goaltender is crying. Okay, that's a reaction. Action, reaction. The action happens, the fans cheer. That's a reaction, right? So where are you pointing your camera? What are you looking for? Maybe the fans are sad. Action, reaction. Oh no, we just lost the game. Action, reaction. What are their teammates doing? Maybe he score a goal and the teammates are going crazy on the bench. You know, what's that reaction? So it's really being aware of the whole story of what's going on, you know, and certainly not just capture the cheering. Like you said, let's get the heads hanging too. That's where the real emotion is. We have too many cheering photos, I feel like, out there. Everybody's roaring. And roaring's great, but it gets boring too, like kicking a soccer ball. So what else can you make?
Exactly. A friend of mine, David Williams, calls it the Eiffel Tower effect, where everybody takes the same picture. You know, the picture of the guy cheering, the guy who's just scored the goal, for example. You know, everybody's going to be focused on him and everybody's going to take the same picture, but it does pay off to actually turn around and see what else is going on. Because for every goal scored, is what I'm trying to say, there'll be a goal lost almost on the other side. You know, so it's always this two-sided sword, and just turning around and looking at, you know, what's happening away from the main action can actually make for a much better story, you know, in that sort of context. So that's, you know, that's the thing that fascinates me.
I was shooting the World Baseball Classic this past March, and Colombia was about to get eliminated, and there was a chance that they wouldn't even make it because of the scoring, even to the next world, even qualify for the next one. So it was a lot on the line for them. But when you're playing for your country and country pride, it's pretty powerful when you're wearing, you know, that flag on your chest or your country on your chest. And so those games come usually with a lot of high emotion, whatever the sport is. And as like the game was winding down and it was tight, I knew my job was going to be to run over to Colombia's bench and ignore the winners, you know. So, but it's risky, you know. You want to run where the pack runs, because it just seems like the Eiffel Tower. You run where everybody runs, like all the photographers are running in that direction. So you want to run with them, and you're getting this person getting on the shoulders. It's scary, and you got to be a little bit brave, you know. No risk, no reward. To run over to the losing bench, because maybe you'll get nothing, but you won't know unless you go over there. And, you know, and sometimes you do get nothing, but but when you do, right, the reward, when you make something different, right, instead of making 200 mediocre pictures, you make one special one, maybe that nobody else made. Well, that's a nice payoff.
Yeah. And it's always, I think that's, these kind of stories always garner a lot more interest. I'm just thinking of, there's a TV show that's been on for a while called, I think it's called Welcome to Wrexham. I don't know if you know this. It's like Ryan Reynolds and what's his name? Rob McKellen? I can't pronounce the name. Anyway, the two Hollywood stars who bought a Welsh football club or soccer club, right? But that club wasn't a great club. It was a losing club. You know, it was a no-hopers type of club. Anyway, they bought it and invested some money into it, and then we're trying to turn that club around. I don't know if you heard of that TV show. I think it's on Netflix.
Oh, but I want to watch it. It sounds really fun. Yeah,
it is super great. Fun. And you know, we're talking about a club in what we call over here the ass end of Wales. I mean, it literally is not. It's not. It's out in the prairie. I mean, it's like, you know, it's a small club. But these two Hollywood stars go and buy this club anyway, and then of course turn it into a TV show. But the really interesting thing about that is, you know, by the end of the first season, I remember, you know, they were like trying really hard to get up into the next league, you know, but they fail at the end. The human story in that is so emotionally charged that you really feel for each one of those players. They've like given everything. And in a sense, you've hoped that they, you know, you've been like in there with them, like you hope that they can make it, you know, and then they fail, and you really, you know, you're just as distraught as the rest of them, And I think it's season two that actually gets through to the next. I'm not sure. I haven't seen the latest season, but it's an interesting show. Anyway, follow those soccer fans out there.
When you get that emotion, right? When you make that picture, you know, people are going to get emotional when they look at that. When you make a picture that really moves somebody, you know, when you see it and you want to cry along looking, you know, grown man from Colombia, you know, with his hands and tears in his eyes. And, you know, that's the guy who cares the most. You know, so it's who you're cheering for. It's who has the most passion. And people say, well, how do you take that picture? Well, you should take that picture. He's going to want that picture because he knows he cared the most. Maybe not at the moment that you're taking it. But, you know, when he looks down the line and he sees how much he cared, he'll appreciate it.
Hey, let me just jump in real quick to tell you about the amazing sponsor of this episode, Platypod. Platypod offers innovative camera support systems designed to unleash your creativity. With their stable, versatile, and portable solutions, you can capture stunning shots like never before. And I'm not just saying that. As the host of the Camera Shake podcast, I can personally vouch for Platypod's incredible products. They've become an integral part of the show. In fact, I'm surrounded by various Platypod products holding up lights, cameras, microphones, and so on. It's really helped to transform the way I make the show and the way I shoot at home, in the studio, and on location. But don't just take my word for it. Explore Platypod's website at www.platypod.com to discover their range of products, including the Platypod Extreme, Platyball tripod heads, and the brand new handle, of course. Make sure to follow Platypod on Instagram and Facebook at Platypod Tripods for exclusive updates, tips, and giveaways. By choosing Platypod, you're not only investing in your photography, but you're also supporting the Camera Shake Photography Podcast. Thanks again to Platypod, our amazing sponsor. Platypod, where innovation never sleeps. And again, that's, you know, that is exactly where the interest lies. Like these, you know, the juxtaposition between, you know, just imagine, I mean, you talk about football as an American football earlier. You get these huge guys that, like, you know, mountains of muscle. And then by the end of the game, they are distraught and in tears. It's just that juxtaposition that you see come out, that humanity that comes out all of a sudden. That's so super interesting.
Yeah. I love it. And it's true. And it's any sport, you know, that's what's so exciting about shooting sports is, you know, it's photojournalism. You're telling a story. You have to be ready for it to unfold. So you're preparing, but you know, you don't get to control what happens or when it happens. So there's so much to it. There's so much adrenaline that's tied into it. Can't get enough.
Exactly. And, you know, and from a purely from a technical perspective, as a photographer, it's really challenging as well. I learned that. So I started shooting boxing events maybe 4 years ago or something. I started shooting boxing events. And I do them every year. I probably do about maybe 10, 12 events every year. And when I first got into it, when I first started that, I thought, yeah, no problem. I come from a music photography background, so I know how this works. You know, fast action in dimly lit environments. Yeah, absolutely no problem. Boy, was I wrong, because just like you mentioned this earlier, but I remember after the first fight, I thought, I think I'm not using the right equipment. This is like something's not working.
In every sport, you know, the more you know the sport, the better you're going to shoot it, right? Whatever they're doing, the athlete repeats himself. He does the same thing every time. So if it's a boxer, his footwork is like the same. He punches the same way. He'll block the same way. And if you know the sport and you know the athlete, you're going to know where to stand, where to, you know, what to expect. So you can be ready and capture it. But if you know nothing about the sport and it's the first time you're seeing these two guys, you think you might know about boxing, but there's so much to it, you know, being able to shoot it. I shot boxing for the first time with Neil Leifer, of all people, to shoot my first boxing. He took me to my first boxing match in Madison Square Garden. And Neil is 80 years old. Oh, no, he's 81 now. Neil probably doesn't want me saying his age on this, but he is. I said it. And he's still shooting. He's a Sony Artisan of Imagery. He uses the latest equipment. He's incredible. Like, he's still, and, you know, and nobody knows boxing. And he, of course, took the most famous boxing photo, you know, with Muhammad Ali over Liston, you know, that famous one. And and learning from someone like that, again, who knows the sport, you know, Neil knows exactly like what, you know, what to do, where to stand, where to go, what's going to happen, and all those things, you know, that you don't just get to walk in and just shoot it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Again, you know, I bring that back to my own experience. I remember the first time I shot a boxing fight, I really didn't know anything about boxing. Like, two guys getting at each other. That's basically all I knew. And it's also then, you know, it's like realizing what kind of shots work, you know, and realizing when to move. The great thing for me is I have super close access. I'm literally hanging over the ropes. I mean, that's how close I am. And so I can get up on the ringside, like literally right by the ropes. So I can be eye level with the fighters right there. So it's an incredible opportunity to get shots. In fact, I mean, it's happened more than once that I had my camera body pushed into my eye socket. Especially when you're shooting wide, you don't realize how close they are. You think they're much further away than they are. And before you know it, you end up with
that. I've been boxing a few times, and I've been on ringside. It's also pretty gross, like, you know, but that's where fighters are made. Again, it's that wide angle, right? Being that intimate and moving around. You don't want everything to be wide angle. So moving away from the ring and being able to shoot with a telephoto lens and have a different look, you know, makes the story interesting too. But there's nothing like that ringside with a wide angle. It's beautiful, beautiful pictures. Yeah. But knowing the sport, I mean, the first thing I do if I'm shooting something I'm not familiar with is I look up who did it best, right? So you look up the Neil Leifers and you find the right photographers who've done it better than you'll ever do it. And you look at their pictures and at least know what you ought to be, you know, and what you're striving for. So I think that's just always a nice way to start. What do I want these pictures to look like and what should they look like?
And you're absolutely right. Knowing the sport is so important. I had a conversation with David Berkman not too long ago, and he shot a lot of American football in the past. And really interesting conversation. And I remember him saying, like, well, you know, with American football, you need to know where to be before that gameplay actually happens. So you need to be able to think ahead and go like, right, this is about to happen. I'm going to have to position myself there because I'm going to get that shot from that side of the stadium or, you know, from that position. And it's just knowing the sport well enough to know that this is about to happen and I got to move myself now is super important. Otherwise, you're just going to be missing the shot all the time.
Yeah, you're going to be, but you want to be in front of the ball and in front of the player. Exactly. So, I mean, what David's doing, he's like, okay, it's third down. He knows the team. He's probably shot the team over and over again, you know, and I shot the 49ers for many years. And so, you know, okay, like, you know who they're going to throw the ball to, or you can anticipate or at least have an idea of what. And there's nothing like knowing the sport. So you run down and you put yourself in position for the picture you want to make. And then it's luck, right? Because, you know, sports photography is luck, you know, and you work hard for your luck. But then when the play does happen, you don't miss. You certainly try not to. So it's all of that. And that's what makes it so fun. But yeah, there's nothing like knowing the sport and knowing the team.
Yeah. And knowing the participants. There's a funny thing that happens in amateur boxing a lot is you have, especially a lot of the time with the guys. So what happens is they are like super eager and super pumped up. They've got to last three rounds unless they get knocked out. But basically that's the idea. They fight three rounds and they get into it with all cylinders steaming. Like, you know, it's like super high energy in the first round. And I already, at that point, when the first round starts like that, I know they're going to be tired as heck by the end of round two. And I know I'm not going to have to worry about, you know, about the movement of the action too much because I know I'm going to get some much calmer shots in the third round because they're done. They're not going to be, nobody's fit enough to last through three rounds at that sort of high energy level.
Wear that headgear with the amateur, do they wear those? The headgear, like, that protects their face. Yeah, I shot amateur too. The first time I did it afterwards, I came home and I told my son, I go, the pictures weren't good. They're wearing all this headgear. You can't see their faces. And he's like, Mom, do you know what would happen to them if they didn't wear that? You know, because my son knows sports. I was like, oh yeah, I suppose that's true. But yeah,
the hesitation. So, I mean, it's you know, it's true. Despite the so the events at iShoot are really well controlled, and they're as safe as they could ever be. You know, there's a medical team ringside, there's an ambulance outside. They're very, you know, they're very, very safety conscious. But with every event, something goes wrong at some point. I've seen so many knockouts, despite all the headgear and everything. You know, I've seen people taken out of the ring, you know, put in an ambulance and driven off to hospital. I mean, all of that happens. And of course, I always wonder, why would you put yourself through that, like voluntarily? What's up with that? You know, but boxing's boxing. Right? They hit each other, you know?
Yeah, I know. And it's a great sport. I mean, the photos can really be beautiful. And just even what the atmosphere is, if you've got a good crowd, you know, just the geometry and the structure of the ring, if you can find an up position and shoot down, it makes it so interesting to see all of that and the colors. And yeah, I think there's a lot to it. And the details of boxing is interesting. A boxing gym, I've shot in boxing gyms a lot, and I love that, especially if you get a gritty one. There's like a lot of pictures to be made in a boxing gym.
Yeah. Yeah, boxing is super interesting. The other thing, it's the same organization. They do boxing events and cage fighting events. And, you know, cage fighting events are super, they're hilarious because, you know, you always think, oh, yeah, cage fighting, that's going to be a lot of action. And but the truth of the matter is, the bigger the guy is, the sluggisher
the fight.
And it's like, I always think like, you know, okay, there's two guys hugging on the floor. I'm not really sure there's a good shot in that.
Yeah, I shot high school wrestling. It took me forever to like figure out, but the lighter weight ones certainly had more movement and was figuring all that. Yeah, and when you get to that higher weight classes, it's a completely different game. So yeah, same thing with boxing. But,
what was the transition like for you, like moving on from, let's say, amateur sports to, like, you know, to shooting in big stadiums and shooting like big national teams? What was that like for you?
I mean, the interesting thing for me is I was doing both simultaneously because I connected with Michael Zegaris pretty early on in my sports part of my career. I was able to be shooting the Oakland A's and the San Francisco 49ers while I was also shooting these youth sports. So I was sort of learning on a big field so I could get my little gig done. And the combination was really fun for me. I mean, the first time I walked onto a big field, I mean, I would think it's probably the same for everybody. You think everything's a picture, right? You're on a major league baseball field and you overshoot like crazy. Like, oh, look, you know, there's a player standing there. I need 30 frames per second of him doing absolutely nothing, you know? There's the mascot. Here's another 60 pictures, you know? And then you have an editing nightmare when you go home because you know, and then you're seeing this player that's just standing there like a tree growing out of a baseball field. And it's like, why did I need 30 pictures of this or even one? So, you know, I think that excitement, you know, of being everything looks interesting and is almost overwhelming. And it takes a while to like calm that down and make pictures and say, okay, now, you know, I've got to shoot the game and I've got to pay attention and just treat it like anything else, you know? And that's really, you know, I think as the experience goes on, shooting a World Series is no different than shooting a Little League game. I mean, once the game starts, it starts and they play the game, you know, and the Little League game goes 6 innings and the World Series goes, you know, 9 innings. And you hope for more. But you're just doing the same thing. They're playing the same game. And the more you know, it's all the same. It's very formulaic. It's you know, almost boring in that way. Not boring for me, but it's a formula. And it's, you know, and the more relaxed you are and it's preparation, then you're going to make the pictures. And it's having a plan, you know. And every game I shoot, I know the pictures I want to make or have an idea. It doesn't always work out, of course, but there is a plan right up until the end of the game. Okay, it's about, you know, this is who's winning, who's losing, where do I want to stand, what do I want to capture, where am I going to be pointing my camera, what lens am I going to be using, you know, and all of those things are happening before the game is over. So, okay, I'm going to be on this player, I'm going to be at the end of the game, I'll get the last play, I'm going to turn because I want this guy celebrating or this guy in defeat. and where my position is. Of course, if it's a big game, you don't have a choice, right? You have your spot is your spot. You don't get to move. So then you got to make the best picture from where you are. But if you do get to move, then you want to be in a position. So you think about that, not at the last minute, like, oh, the game's about to end, and start running. No, you get over there way in advance and know what you want to shoot and what lens you're going to shoot it with. And then all those, like, you know, little things that are not so little, you know, are your batteries, you have a fresh battery in there, or your card. You don't want to start shooting a celebration and your card is full, right? So all of those things that you learn and you prepare for. And then when you're prepared and you get there early and you have a plan, it's so relaxing. Then you're not all wound up because you know exactly what you're going to do. Step one, step two, step three, go through your list in your head and then have a good getaway car, get out of the crowd.
What does your planning process look like before a game? What's the sort of the process you go through to prepare for a game like that?
It just depends on who I'm shooting for and what I want to capture. So like when I was shooting for La Vida Baseball, they want me to tell the Latin story. So they'll give me a list, a shooting list of who they want me to get. And they're not expecting me to get every one of those, but, you know, I got to do the best I can. And then there might be storylines that are important. Or if I'm shooting for myself, it's the same thing. Am I shooting for a book or am I shooting for what am I shooting for? What am I trying to capture? There's nothing easier if it's just one athlete, right? If you're telling the story of one athlete, it's such a luxury because you can follow that athlete and just do all the different angles of that athlete. So it's, you know, what pictures am I trying to make? What story am I trying to tell? What's the message I'm trying to convey? And all of that to me is before I even get in the car to drive or, you know, get to the game. So I have that plan of what I would like to make, what I'm trying to accomplish, and then getting there really early. So, okay, I have my list of what I want, you know, what's ideal, what I'd like to make. Now, where am I going to shoot it from? What positions are available to me? What lenses am I going to need to capture that? So it's like, okay, I'll know if I want to do an overhead, a scene setting, I'll do that maybe in the third inning because the light will probably be best then. And I go up and I scout those positions before there's any fans in the stands. So, and I know exactly then what staircase I'm going to go up, what door I'm going to go through, exactly where I want to stand, what lens. And then it only takes a minute to make the picture because all the work has already been done. So when there's 50,000 people in the stadium, I'm not scrambling to figure it all out. I'm just walking over to my spot, know what my camera settings are going to be, and I'm taking my picture pretty quickly and moving along. And so I think just having all those planned. Now, with all that, something unfolds that you can't anticipate what is going to happen. But when you are prepared and you are you have such a strong plan, it's easy to pivot because you see something, you're not worried about missing something else, you know, and you can adjust and you know, make your plan. Like if I'm shooting a multi-day event, I'll say, okay, the best day for fans is going to be the first day because that's when they're most excited. They're coming in, their team is in the big game. It'll probably be the biggest crowd or whatever it is. And I'll get my fan shots done, you know, and it sounds like I'm just getting them done. But that doesn't mean I'm not going to shoot a fan the rest of the series. It means that I gave myself this particular time to get a bunch of fan shots. And then when I see something interesting, somebody's walking around in a lizard costume for some reason or whatever, or somebody's painted their face or put a lot of effort into, you know, or they're animated, I get that fan shot and I add it to my fan shots. So it's all planning, you know, it's the creative process for me is planning, planning, planning.
And I think that's a really important thing to recognize. I think for anybody who wants to get into sports photography is that pre-planning process. You know, I think there's two things. In order to get successful at something like this, I think there's two elements that are important. One is the planning, and then there's the experience. Because as you mentioned, things always go wrong. Like something always goes wrong. And then it's the experience that you can draw on that helps you to get out of that fix.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, when like early days, something goes wrong, you're spinning, you know, or you in sports, you missed something, you know, you missed something and that feeling is horrible, right? This big play that happened and maybe you're in a photo well with 20 other photographers and they're all looking at the back, checking their shot. And you don't have to look at the back of yours because you knew, you know, you didn't get it. And it's such a horrible feeling. I think that the horrible feeling is good because it feels so bad, you're never going to do it again. You should find a way to make sure that doesn't happen. So it's a strong lesson, you know, and we learn from those lessons. So I think, but when you do miss, and everybody misses, you know, and you try to miss less and you try to get better, but you can't let it spin you, because if things go wrong and it spins you, then you're going to miss the next thing. It's right. It'll just, you're so upset that you missed that shot. Now another thing happened and you're going to miss that. It's really like an athlete, right? The athlete's the same. If the athlete misses a catch or misses a goal, if they don't have a strong mental game, they're going to miss the next thing. So they have to learn as premier athletes to throw that in the garbage as quickly as possible and now do better moving forward right away. They have no time. The game is still happening. Unless I miss that catch, but we got to keep playing and I got to be at the top of the game. Same thing for photographers.
Yeah, because if you're mentally preoccupied with, you know, with something that's just gone wrong, you are going to miss the next thing that's going to happen. There's nothing you can do about that. And then, of course, the frustration builds and, you know, you get more and more frustrated. And at some point, you might as well just throw the towel in and just give up. But it's about staying mentally strong. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
And, you know, we're not mentally strong all the time or whatever. And we all have bad shoots and bad days. And, you know, people say, wow, you just always do well. It's like, well, no, I don't. You just see only the good ones, right? I mean, that's what social media is, you know, everybody's showing their best stuff. And of course they should. But it's also good to know that we all have off days, bad days. Working with the young man who's just doing terrific. And over the last 2 years, his game has grown so much. His photography and so great to see. And he just came back from a shoot and he goes, I just got absolutely nothing. And like, I'm terrible. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, this is the first time this has happened to you in 2 years. Like, you consider yourself lucky. I mean, we've all been there where we've just had a really crummy shoot. I mean, and got nothing, you know, and it's just the way it is.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I learned this in a former life as a musician. I learned this, you know, you play a gig and nothing works out. Like, you've rehearsed and you've practiced, you can play everything in your sleep, but then the moment you're up there in front of an audience, everything goes wrong. Like, you know, you can't, as a guitarist, like, you know, can't hear my guitar, the sound is terrible, nothing feels right. It's just, you know, but, you know, you go back and you basically, that's what I used to do. I used to deconstruct what just happened. So I used to kind of go like, okay, well, all right, I didn't play that part of this particular tune very well. Well, it's just something I can do about that next time around. You know, I couldn't hear my guitar very well. Well, there's going to be something I can do about that. Maybe next time I need to have a closer conversation with the sound guy, or, you know, or make sure I stand in a different way. There's always something you can do, as long as you, you know, don't throw in the towel and actually just go back and deconstruct what's just happened. And with photography, you know, again, I come back to the equipment. I mean, I think the first 3 boxing events that I shot, I definitely had equipment issues. It just wasn't working for me in the same way that I thought it should work, because I thought, well, like I said, you know, I thought music photography and shooting sports can't be that different. You know, they're not particularly well lit a lot of the time, and there's fast action. So what can be the difference? But it turns out, I learned very quickly that there's a huge difference. In fact, it almost has nothing to do with the other, you know? And so, yeah, so, you know, I had to make equipment choices, and I also had to learn how to use my equipment in a different way, you know, in order to get those shots.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's right. I mean, the gear matters, and we know that. And people say, well, you know, isn't it the photographer? Well, sure, you'd like to say it's all, but no. I mean, the gear that we have now is so exciting. I mean, there's just so much out there that we could utilize to make better pictures that we were never able to make before. You know, and people are like, oh, the good old days when there was film and, you know, and manual focus, those were real photographers. Yeah, those were really good photographers, but I'm sure happy to have autofocus, you know, and really good autofocus. So, you know, to me, technology is allowing us to make pictures that, wow, you couldn't make before. I mean, and it's exciting. And the technology also does so much of the technical job for you if you take the time to learn it. So then you're free to frame, compose, and create things that you couldn't. If you're worried about making sure it's in focus, well, that's taking up a majority of your time. But if you don't have to worry about that, and now you're just, what do you want it to look like? Where do you want to frame and compose? I mean, just incredible. And then, of course, in sports photography, the amount of times that you're able to capture an athlete at his or her peak moment certainly increases with the technology that we've got there.
Big time. So. I've noticed this. This is part of my learning curve, let's say, in shooting boxing events. You know, I remember when I first started shooting boxing events, I shot a DSLR. And, you know, I'd come home and I'd load my shots up. And I'd say maybe 40% or something of the shots, there was something wrong with them. Either it missed focus or, you know, something wasn't. It's usually focus issues. And that was fine. That was just something I sort of took into consideration, and that was just how it was. Cool. Then eventually I switched to mirrorless, and I shoot Nikon. So Nikon's mirrorless technology is actually, you know, the autofocus technology has come a long way since the days of DSLRs. And I have to say, my issue now is I don't really have many shots to weed out. Like, you know, it's like out of the, let's say, 4,000 shots that I've shot, I mean, literally 3,990 are in focus. And it was like, oh, shit, that's a lot of shots I have to go. It was so easy to just, you know, weed them out earlier. Now,
it's a completely different thing. I was just talking to my friend Kayla, and she works with Sony. And I said to her, God, you know, we were talking about the new A9 III, you know, and it shoots 120 frames per second. Do we need 120 frames per second all the time? Of course not. Do I want that? You bet I want that. Why wouldn't I want that for when I need it? And I said, the job is now is becoming a better editor because you upped your game, right? So it's learning how to be a better editor. And I've learned how to be a better editor over the years. I've had somebody incredible teaching me, this guy, Steve Fine, who worked for Sports Illustrated for years. And he was the photo editor there and head of photography. And, you know, you have to know what a picture is and what it isn't. And he's so fast. He's still, of course, much faster than me. And having somebody else edit your pictures, that is not emotionally connected to them, really helps you. Somebody hands it back to you and says, this is the best one and here's why. And yeah, I know you like that one because you worked so hard to get it, but it doesn't make it the best picture. You just remember how hard you worked to get it. But so all of the things that it takes. And now, I mean, I'm so fast. And now as I'm shooting with these new cameras, I know I've got to edit quickly. I got to move along. And it doesn't matter that I have 100 frames of this shot. There's still only one peak one. There's one best one. There's one athlete at his or her peak moment. And do you know which one that is? And getting good at that and being able to get fast at it. It's fun. It's a new fun part of the job. Yeah. Or not new, but better at it.
How much editing goes into the images that you deliver? Does any editing go into it?
I'm going through my takes as fast as I can. I mean, I was just in the Dominican Republic and I'm going from one shoot to another. I'm putting my card in and sitting in the back of a car and actually going through my take and and I do ones and twos for what I'm going to keep and moving along to the next one. And it's great to be getting, you know, fast at it. You don't want to make mistakes, so you can only go as fast as, you know, you're capable of going. And then just delivering, you know, if I make an adjustment, it might be a little batch adjustment before I send, you know, maybe I have to pick up the shadows a little bit or, you know, pump up a little bit of, you know, something that it needs, but we'll bring down highlights or whatever it is that, you know, but it's quick, you know, and sports photography is quick. Delivering is quick. You know, and then I'll spend a little more time on something that might go into, like, on my website, you know, that you want to take more time. You don't want to just throw stuff up there. So you'll take a little bit more time with those photos and your archives, and you have some more time to work with them.
But that's certainly one major mistake I made. Again, at the very beginning when I first started shooting boxing, it was like I was so nervous about delivering the shots, you know. And so I went into editing overkill. And yeah. It was stupid. And, I spent days, and I can't remember how many, maybe I delivered, I don't know, maybe 800 shots or something like that. That was the gig. So somewhere in that region anyway. And I spent days painstakingly editing them. And of course now, 4 years later, my workflow is completely different. Like, there is no such thing as like individual shot image editing. You know, it's all batched up.
But it's fun to remember that you did that. I mean, we all did that, right? Going through, taking forever, not being sure, you know, and then individually like trying to like make, and you can't do that, you know. But cropping, I crop really fast too, because, you know, cropping is part of sports photography. So, yeah. You know, you crop in, you can make something better, you get tighter into the action, you know, and whatever long lens you have, you know, the great thing is these files are nice and big. So we're able to crop in and make something, you know, make a more impactful photo after the photo is taken. So everybody says crop in the camera. And yes, you crop in the camera, you should frame and compose properly. But I'll crop in for impact, you know, for sure, after the fact.
And again, you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, I've developed certain workflows over the years that just make it easy for me to basically, I batch, because I have to deliver in 7x5s. That's the requirement for this particular gig. So I batch crop the whole shebang. And then since I sort of do a super quick edit in Lightroom, what I do is I keep the crop tool open, and I just use a graphics tablet and I literally just make a super quick crop adjustment and then flick immediately onto the next picture. So I don't have to come in and out of the crop tool every time, because, you know, I figure it's like, you know, if I've got to deliver 800 shots on average, sometimes anywhere between 600 and 1,000, I guess, depending on the event, you know, even one click on the graphics tablet, for example, or one move multiplied by 1,000 takes a lot of time, you know. So if I can minimize that and just make that as straightforward and simple as possible, I actually save myself a lot of time. And so, you know, I probably spend a couple of hours on a job like that now rather than days. And that's, you know, that's huge.
Yeah, it is huge. And you got, I mean, it sounds like you got your system down. The whoever the client is, they're not paying you for days of editing.
Exactly. That's exactly it.
Yeah, and you got to move on and go to the next thing and know you're delivering, you know, a good product to them. But, you know, I was thinking of something that you talked about, being a musician and us having bad days. There's also my friend Steve a lot, because he's given me so much. But he also, like, there'll be times when I'm shooting day after day after day after day, and then like I just don't see it, and I'm like really struggling and have a bad shoot. And it may not be a technical problem. It may just be a me problem. Like, it may just be. And he said, you know, there are some times when you got to just put the camera down. And I would think that as a musician, like for you, like sometimes you just got to put the guitar down, like, you know, if you're like, and just give yourself that rest of like, okay, I'm just not seeing it. I'm not hearing it. I'm not bringing it today. Give yourself that break, you know, and if you can put it down and just give yourself a rest, and, you know, give yourself a day or two or whatever it is before you pick up the guitar again, before you pick up the camera again. That's it. Yeah. We don't talk about it enough. I think it's a good one to put out there for people.
It's absolutely super important as a musician. You know, I mean, for me, I figured it out like when I was probably in my mid-teens or something, that sometimes, you know, you can sort of start suffering from something, I don't know, I usually call it sort of creative overkill, where it's just, you know, your brain is just flooded with all these different ideas and things that are coming through, and, you know, you can't really compute them all, and all sort of, it's like a funnel. So this is how I always used to describe it to my students at the time. It's like a funnel. You know, you pour water into the funnel, And in order for it to not overflow, you can only pour so fast. If you start pouring faster, the whole thing's going to overflow. And then what you got to do is you're just going to have to stop pouring for a while, let the water go through and the funnel empty out, and then you start pouring again. It's exactly what you just described, you know. Sometimes you have to put the instrument down, you know, put the guitar down, and then actually do something completely different. Don't go listen to music, right? Don't go watch guitar videos on YouTube, but actually do something different. You know, spend a couple of days following another hobby, right? Just do family things, like do something that's completely unrelated with music. And whilst you're doing that, your brain subconsciously actually works through all of that other stuff. And the interesting thing is then when you get back to it, things miraculously and mysteriously start to work a lot better. And it's like your brain's been doing the work whilst you were doing other things. You know, you just let your brain work on its own.
So true. So well said. Yeah. Yeah. And good advice. Good advice for all of us.
Yeah. And it's so true in photography. I mean, it's on this particular podcast, as everybody who listens to this podcast knows, I hop on about this virtually almost every week. You know, there's so many parallels between music and photography, because they're both creative pursuits that are really very similar. You know, one is a visionary thing. The other thing is an auditory thing. But it's ultimately the same thing. You know, we're creating stuff. I always think, you know, I think of it this way, like the really cool thing. Well, the thing that's always motivated me personally in creative pursuits, like music and photography and video as well, because I like making videos. I like shooting little things. It's the fact that you start out with nothing, thin air. Then you have an idea. Then you go through a process and you make things happen. You create something. And in the end, you have something that didn't actually exist earlier. And so now you have a tangible thing that you've just made, a piece of music, a photograph, a video that tells a story, whatever it may be. But that didn't exist before. And the process of that is the thing that's always motivated me, that's always fascinated me, you know. And that's one of the reasons, actually, why. That's part of the reason why I started this podcast in the first place. Because the thing that always interests me is the process. You know, talking to, you know, people like yourself and a lot of the guests that I've had on the show in the past, it's like I try to work out, like, what is the process, you know, the creative process that somebody goes through to make the thing that they make, you know. And that to me is always super fascinating.
Yeah, it really is. And yeah, I can see the similarities. It makes so much sense. My best friend is a musician and he creates, you know, almost all of his own music and the process that he goes through. And it's probably one of the reasons why we're best friends, you know, just that creative process and good days and bad days with it. So hopefully more good days than bad days.
Absolutely. What's the next thing for you? Like, what's coming up for you next?
Oh, well, this project is really the all-consuming project, is telling the story of women in baseball. And for the first time, I'm working in video in a significant way. And so directing the video and being able to figure out what I want. And, you know, it's very different, you know, in video versus a still. My heart is still in still photography. And even as I do this project, I'm more sure than ever that I love still photography. Like, that's where my heart is going to always be. And I'm trying to balance being able to do the video that I need, but also still want to get the stills that I want for the project. And that's been a tricky balance, and I wasn't very good at in the beginning of the project, and I'm starting to improve and get better at it as time goes on. But it's fun to see, it's fun telling a story in a different way that I haven't been before. So there's a lot of firsts for me, which I think is good for your brain, especially when you get to a certain age, to keep learning new things. I might have put too many in there for this project to do all at once, but it's great. It's great. It keeps me like, you know, when you can't sleep and you start thinking about what you should do the next day, and you're thinking and writing down at 2 o'clock in the morning, you shouldn't do that. You should go to sleep. But when you're that excited about something, and that's where I'm at now. And this project will take me through this year. So it's fun.
Well, yeah, and you're just, you're off to South Korea.
South Korea. Women play baseball there. And that's the exciting part of this, right? It's not the game. The game is played the same everywhere. Baseball, you know, says the same rules pretty much, but it looks different in different places. And it's the cultural difference, you know, the geography, the topography, the landscaping, the, you know, what does it look like? What culturally is different? What are they wearing? What do the fans look like? And then, of course, it's women playing the game. And so what does that look like, you know, and what are the differences there, and telling those cultural stories? And, you know, and that's what's interesting, you know, the sport, you know, sure, game action is always interesting, but there's so much more with telling a story like this.
Is that something that's sort of rising or increasing, just generally the participation of girls in sports like baseball, especially in Asia? I think baseball is popular in Japan, for example, as well.
Yeah, I mean, actually, Asia's Japan and Korea are ahead of the game for women in baseball. They have leagues. They have Korea has a big women's league with all women players, women playing with other women, a professional league, and Japan has had the same. So there's, and even Cuba has a great program for women playing baseball on a Cuban women's national team. And so there's a lot of exciting headlines and things happening all around the world. But here in the United States, women's baseball is exploding, and the participation of women on all different levels is, it's such an exciting time for the project, because every day there's a new headline, there's a new first. Like now there's a woman who's the first play-by-play announcer has been announced. And she just started, so she'll work for the Oakland A's, and she'll be the first woman doing play-by-play in Major League Baseball. That just was announced. There's an first umpire who's now going to be, you know, and it's every day, a general manager, GM. So it's and then women playing the game. And there's probably over 1,000 girls in the United States now playing baseball on all girls teams. So there's a lot of fun, fun stories, and it's fun when it's firsts, you know. And the women who are doing this now are trailblazers, so they're just paving the way for the future generations.
Yeah, actually, not too long ago, only a few months ago, there was the first woman or first female referee at a rugby, not at a rugby game, but what did I call it? The Five Nations or something. There's a different rugby competitions. There's also like two weird rugby leagues that are slightly different in rules. My wife's a massive rugby fan, and I've only recently learned the rules.
I want to shoot it with mud. I think rugby and mud go together really well. It's got to be like a muddy field,
Yeah. It is fun to watch. I mean, like I said, you know, I've only been sort of introduced to my wife's family are Welsh, although she's Canadian, but her family are from Wales, and rugby is huge in Wales, and they really have thing. Her sister and her mom, I've never seen anybody shout that loud and violently at the TV, when they watch rugby games. It really is crazy. It's like, you know, it's so much fun though. But it's been fun. It's been fun watching those games. It's also something my youngest daughter really got into. She's 12 now, but she really enjoys watching the rugby games. Well, because the games are interesting, but it's because the reactions are so hilarious.
It's great. Yeah, it's fun.
So yeah, fantastic. Jean, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on the show. Thank you so much for being the guest on this week's Camera Shake podcast. I'm sure not the last time. Sports photography is such a rich subject to talk about. There's many things I can imagine we could be telling about when it comes to that on the show. So thank you so much for being on the show today.
This has been so delightful, and I love the tie-in of music and sports. It makes so much sense to me. It's so great. So thank you. Thanks for including me.
Yeah, you're very welcome. It's like I said, I know that there are a lot of people who are really interested in sports photography. I know that some people I know in the area who are members of local camera clubs and stuff, they're always desperately trying to get better at sports photography. So it's actually, well, maybe one final thing. for anybody wanting to get into sports photography or wanting to get better at photography, what would be your top tip?
I would say go to a place where you have access to relax and make pictures and practice. There's nothing like shooting every day in a place where you can, there's always a place, there's always some place you can go where you can shoot and really have access to make the pictures you want. It's hard to do one tip because now it makes me think of five other things I want to say. But yes, for one, so that's the one.
Perfect. James, thank you so much. Okay, folks, that's it for today. It was phenomenal having Gene on the show. And as always, before we go, let me just recommend another episode that I think you'll like. Check out episode 140 with David Bergman, where we talk more sports and music photography. I'm sure you'll love it. If you enjoy our content, consider supporting us on buymeacoffee.com/camerashake to help us continue creating and bringing you more exciting episodes. It really does mean the world to us. I'm not really quite sure why I'm saying us, because it's actually just me. So I should say just me. Anyway, and for those of you who are listening to the audio version of this podcast, did you know that there's a fully fledged video version over on YouTube with plenty of examples of our guest photography in full Technicolor? Well, all you have to do is go over to YouTube, search for Camera Shake Podcast, so that you'll be able to watch all past episodes on there. If you're already on YouTube, however, make sure to drop us a comment, hit that like button, ring the bell, and share with your friends. Your engagement does help us reach a wider audience all over the world. So thank you for listening and watching. And remember, a new episode drops every Thursday, so make sure you mark that in your diary. Until next time, keep shaking things up in the world of photography. See you next Thursday.